Welcome to the Summer of Peace, a free global online event designed to help you find inner peace and to take inspired action. The Summer of Peace is a production of the Shift Network, and this Subtle Activism Summit is co-produced with the Gaia Field Project. The Subtle Activism Summit brings together leading scientists, mystics, and activists to illuminate the crucial role of spiritual practice in the global peace movement. We are grateful that you're here. Please share your questions or insights on www.facebook.com/shiftnetwork. And now, your host for this call, David Nickel, director and co-founder of the Gaia Field Project.
Okay, so welcome everyone to this Subtle Activism Summit, part of the Summer of Peace program, which is a production of the Shift Network. My name is David Nickel, director of the Gaia Field Project, and just delighted that you're joining us for this very exciting and inaugural Subtle Activism Summit. So we're talking in the next few days with leading mystics, scientists, and activists about the possibility that our spiritual practices, our meditations, our prayers, our rituals, can be a source of support not only for our individual development, but also for the whole, for the earth, for all of humanity, for all of our social, cultural, and political systems. We're exploring and advancing the idea that not only is this approach a possibility, but that it may indeed be a crucial step needed at this time to bring back a sense of the sacred into the collective psyche, into our public dialogue, so that this awareness of our deeper interconnection with each other and with all of life can inform all of the outer changes that need to occur to bring our world into balance. So I'm delighted to launch this Subtle Activism Summit with very esteemed guest, Llewellyn Vaughan Lee. Llewellyn Vaughan Lee, PhD, he's a Sufi teacher in the Naqshbandiya Mujahidiyya Sufi Order. He was born in London in 1953. He's followed the Naqshbandi Sufi path since he was 19. In 1991, he became the successor of Irini Tweedy, author of Daughter of Fire, a diary of a spiritual training with a Sufi master. He then moved to Northern California and founded the Golden Sufi Center. He's the author of many books. He specialized in the area of dream work, integrating the ancient Sufi approach to dreams with the insights of Jungian psychology. Since 2000, the focus of his writing and teaching has been on spiritual responsibility in our present time of transition and an awakening global consciousness of oneness. More recently, he's written about the emerging feminine, the anima mundi, or world soul, and spiritual ecology. He's been recently interviewed by Oprah Winfrey on Super Soul Sunday and featured on the Global Spirit series shown on PBS. His websites, for those wanting to connect more with his work, are workingwithoneness.org, goldensufi.org, goldensufi.org, and spiritualecology.org. So Llewellyn, it's an honor to have you on the program, and welcome.
Well, welcome. Wonderful to talk to you, David, about this incredibly important subject, and I think you hit the nail on the head when you talked about how we have to bring an awareness of the sacred back into our, not just our personal, but our public dialogue. And just to begin, I was deeply moved and overjoyed by reading the Pope Francis's encyclical, which spoke exactly about that in a way that I hadn't believed possible, coming from such a person or such a collective organization. I was so deeply moved by the care for our common home, the encyclical, and hearing the cry of the earth as well as the cry of the poor. So it's really a very important, timely topic that we are discussing, I think.
Right, yeah, I agree, and thank you. And I wonder if a good place to start, Llewellyn, is perhaps just to comment generally on this notion, this potential significance of really bringing an orientation to our spiritual lives that goes beyond just the focus on individual development, and one that does include the earth and all of its systems. And curious your thoughts about how this approach is not only perhaps healthy for us personally, but also could actually have an impact on the world.
Yes, I think this is absolutely vital. I think more is, why have we forgotten this? Because in my own spiritual research, in my own spiritual tradition, for example, servanthood or service is an essential part of spiritual practice. If you look in many traditions, I mean, for example, one shaman who wrote, you know, shamans are sometimes considered healers or doctors, but really they are people who deal with the tears and holes we create in the net of life, the damage that we all cause in our search for survival. That's from the shamanic tradition. If you think of many other traditions, the Kabbalistic tradition that has this beautiful saying, first we receive the light, then we impart the light, thus we repair the world. That they all have in their very depths that the spiritual practice is for the sake of the whole. We are not separate from the whole, and whether the monk or nun praying in their cell included all of humanity in their prayers, like the tradition of the Bodhisattva who turns away from enlightenment to help lead all sentient beings back to the light. And it's the fact that we have forgotten this aspect of really that is most grounded in all spiritual practice, and somehow our spirituality has been subverted by the individual, by the ego, that it's about us. And for example, in our Sufi tradition, we say, at the very beginning, take one step away from yourself and behold the path. And we have to turn away from our individual self and reclaim our connection to the whole, because in my understanding, spiritual practice has to nourish the whole of humanity, the whole of creation. And particularly at this time in our planet's survival, in this ecocide we are perpetrating, the body, and I would say even the soul, or especially the soul of the earth, needs our prayers, needs our devotion, needs our love. I've been very moved by Joanna Macy, who has a similar understanding of spiritual practice, and that she said it's our love for the world that is needed to help heal this whole ecological devastation we are inflicting upon it.
Right. So, Llewellyn, you brought up Joanna Macy and her work of encouraging us to love the world as a critical piece in solving this environmental crisis we're in. And you've spoken at length about the need to understand the environmental crisis as something more than just a scientific issue. And, you know, it tends to be in our public dialogue spoken about only in those terms, or political terms, or economic terms. You wrote about this in your book, Spiritual Ecology, at length, about how if we relate to the earth as a sacred and living being, it really would be unthinkable for us to treat her the way that we do, so that shift in consciousness can be critical in resolving some of these environmental problems that can't be resolved simply at a technical level. And as you said now, the Pope's encyclical on climate change has really moved that perspective front and center to the mainstream. He wrote beautifully about how the environmental crisis is a spiritual issue, a moral issue, not simply a political or economic issue. So I just wonder if you could elaborate a little on that and your sense of the importance of that encyclical in terms of shifting the debate, and also just your own sense generally about this need to frame the environmental crisis in particular as a spiritual issue.
Yes, I mean, when I was first, over a decade ago, you know, I always call myself a traditional mystic, and that I met my teacher when I was 19, I sat at her feet, and what drew me was the inner journey, going deep within in meditation, back to the source, back to the roots of one's being. The Sufis talk about the chambers of the heart, and you go through these very deep inner experiences, turning away from the world. And then in the year 2000, my attention was shifted, not inward, but what is happening in the world, and and what can spirituality play, or what part does it need to play in our present time of global crisis, which is also carries the seeds of a possible transition or transformation, what Joanna Macy calls this shift. And so then I was drawn to look at this environmental crisis, which was drawing more and more attention. And I thought, I've been trained spiritually that when there's an issue, you go to the root of it. Like Rumi says, you return to the root of the root of your own self. And so I went deep inside this, looking at the roots of this environmental crisis. And what I discovered was it was not just this Newtonian shift in consciousness that said the world is an inanimate object and we can treat it in any way we like. It's just a resource to be used, which has become the groundwork of our economic attitude towards the world. How can the world sustain our culture, our way of being? And I discovered deep within that we had turned away from revering the earth as something sacred, something which is an attitude that belongs to every indigenous culture. The earth is our mother, the earth is our sustainer, the earth is something sacred. And as you mentioned in your introduction, to reclaim that relationship to the sacred, that life is sacred, the earth is sacred, and we are all in it together. I've been deeply moved by some of the Native American indigenous teachings, and they have what they call the original instructions which were given to humanity. And part of those original instructions is we have to get along together. And they don't talk just about people, they talk about all of creation, because for them, oneness, unity, naturally, instinctively embodies all of creation. And then, if you like, where my research, where my journey took me even deeper, and this is why I find what you're talking about so vitally important, is that there are also all the subtle realms that, for some extraordinary reason, we as a culture have dismissed, forgotten, rejected. And yet they belong to all of the different spiritual traditions, whether the shaman who works with the spirit realm, or the Tibetan Buddhist who works with the deities and the devas in the land, or the Christian monk who works with the angelic world, who prays for the angels and has icons of the saints. And even the Zen monk immersed in the void in this inner realm, that they also need to be included, and we all have to get along together, because that's how the world is made. And we're all part of this sacred living oneness. And there is this tradition which I've written about a lot, about the world having a soul, what the ancients called the anima mundi. Just as a human being has a soul, so does the world have a soul. This is the ancient relationship of macrocosm and microcosm, that the human being is the microcosm of the whole. And just as we have a spiritual being inside of us, or we are a spiritual being, so is the world a spiritual being. And this was always understood by indigenous people, and as I say, the Tibetan Buddhism and their shamanic practices. And that we need to reclaim this. We need to work together. We need to reclaim this deep spiritual understanding of the world, of creation, and learn once again, or reclaim what we have forgotten, this understanding of how all the worlds work together. And it, what for me is astounding is that we have forgotten this. And that's why I think your work in subtle activism, this subject is so vital, because we talk about spiritual practice and we've focused it just on our own individual self, and it was never intended for that. And there are ways to work with the world as a living spiritual being that belong to our spiritual heritage, and we need to reclaim them, because the world is dying and it needs not just physical help, it needs spiritual help at this time in its journey, which is our journey. We're on this journey together. And this is, I think, incredibly, incredibly important.
Oh, well, thank you. Beautifully said. And I'm so glad that you brought up this idea of the multidimensionality of our worlds and working with these subtle beings and subtle dimensions. It is sometimes something that is really quite taboo to speak about in public. There's such a sense of skepticism towards these realities, but at the same time, it feels like it might be crucial to be working with those realms in terms of invoking the kinds of support that we may need to really come back to that sense of living in a fully sacred, alive world, not this dead, material, lifeless world that we seem to be have more and more embraced that idea. So I feel so.
I think you're
so
very
critical.
Right in using this word taboo. Sorry, I don't want to interrupt. It's just that you said it's a taboo, and I've found being involved as a spiritual teacher in the West for 2.5 decades now, there are certain things you're allowed to talk about and certain things that are really a taboo. And it's like, I always feel that spirituality got hijacked by the self-development movement, that it's all about us and my journey and my destiny. And there's a much bigger picture, and that involves, as you say, the subtle realm, and then even, in a way, more difficult taboo that I've been forced to confront, and this is very personal for me, David, so I may come across with a certain passion, is that we're allowed at the moment to say that the world ecologically is being devastated. That is now culturally accepted. And I've been, say, very grateful for friendship with Joanna Macy, who's really enforced and taught to me about the grief this causes and the grief that you can experience for seeing what is happening to this beautiful, fragile ecosystem, this incredibly beautiful world we've been born into that is so generous to us in so many ways. I have, an apple tree in my garden, and the fruits there are growing, and there's just from one apple tree there is just so many fruit, generosity of the earth that sustains us. And the grief when you see what is happening, and in fact Joanna Macy, one of the things she says is you need a spiritual practice to counter this grief, to contain this grief. And it's very important to be grounded in a spiritual practice. But then I would take it further, and this is where I've encountered a lot of problems, is that I have been forced to see what is happening to the inner worlds as a result of our treatment of the outer world. Now, there is this tradition or understanding that the inner and the outer worlds reflect each other, that this story that all change comes from within, or that the inner and the outer worlds reflect each other. And what I have been forced to see is the devastation that's happening in the inner planes of the soul and of the world soul. And here, I've encountered a lot of reaction that says it's okay to accept that the outer world, the physical world, is being ecologically devastated. We're creating a wasteland. We're creating this, as the Pope said, Pope Francis said, that this is a sort of throwaway culture has created this wasteland in the outer world. It's painful. But there is also what I've seen, which is this inner darkening, this inner wasteland that belongs to the soul and to the world soul. And this is unreported because, as you know from your own work, there is this taboo about the inner world. And to me, this is one of the great acts of censorship in the last 200 years. I use this expression, we belong now in a flat earth society. Most people believe in the flat earth as just the physical world, which was unthinkable to our ancestors. The indigenous people lived partly in the spirit world, partly that was the world that they inhabited. But we have denied all that. It's been censored from us. The books have been burnt, the manuals have been destroyed, and yet we have created in the soul of the world, in the anima mundi, this devastation. And that's again why I talk about the cry of the earth, That's why I titled my book Spiritual Ecology, The Cry of the Earth. And this is actually comes from a saying of Thich Nhat Hanh, who, as you know, is an engaged Buddhist who believes very much in being involved in the world. And he was asked, what can we do? And he said, the first thing we need to do is to listen to the sound of the earth crying. And this inner cry of this pain of the soul of the world, through which the Pope echoed in talking about the cry of the earth and the cry of the poor, and it's all one. But somehow one is allowed to talk about the outer devastation, but to talk about spiritual darkening is a complete taboo in American spiritual culture. That we,
right.
That the inner world could have been affected by our outer actions. Mm-hmm. But it is. Anybody who's been there, and I was taken into the inner worlds in my early 30s, really, into the shamanic worlds, and been there on and off ever since, and I've seen what's happening, and it's terrible. There are toxic wastelands in the inner world, as big as toxic wastelands in the outer world, and we need to work together with the inhabitants of the inner worlds. And just as a last bit in this, in my encounters in the inner world, often the inhabitants of the inner world, the spirit world, they are confused. They don't understand what we are doing. They say to me, we're supposed to be working together, you know, and they can help. They understand. It's like the nature devas understand nature. They can help us with it, but we're not working together, and that's why I think your subtle activism is so important, because we have to work together. We have to work together with the soul of the world, with the spiritual body of the world. They want us to work together with them, the inhabitants of the inner world, the spiritual right. realms. And right. this is really, really important work.
Yeah. I wonder, Llewellyn, if it's a taboo, because there's something that seems especially frightening about the notion that the inner worlds are also polluted. I think it seems to strike us even on a deeper place than when we look out and see all the damage outside. I think there's perhaps some romantic notion that the inner worlds can't be violated.
Absolutely,
yes.
And sadly, even worse, there has been, I don't know if you have encountered it, there has been this commercialization of spirituality in the West. That it is sold and packaged, and often as a kind of something to make you feel better. And, you know, in the inner world, there is all the light and all the love and the reassurance that you want. You know, I was always taught by my teacher, we're soldiers of the two worlds. We work in both worlds. And there is actually, I belong to the Sufi tradition, and one of the names of the Sufis were known as sweepers. And there is a saying, if there were no sweepers, the world would be covered in dust. And, you know, we sweep up the debris of forgetfulness, this forgetfulness of the sacred that causes so much suffering, I think, to the soul, that we live in a culture that's forgotten the sacred and to bring the sacred back. But we have to clean up the mess we have made, and it's not just about feeling good, and there's not just money to be made, there's work to be done, and it's not a work that you get rewarded for or you get more money in your bank account. It's a spiritual work of service, and somehow we have forgotten that in Sufism it is said after the state of oneness comes the station of servanthood, and in fact it's a great privilege to be a servant, to be in service. And we have to reclaim that. We have to reclaim the work that needs to be done. And, you know, I feel very strongly that those of us who have been given a glimpse of the light of the self, which is incredibly precious, incredibly pure, and that we need to learn how to use it in service to the whole, not just to make us feel better. Yes, we should develop compassion and loving kindness, but we should also use that light, that divine spark that we've been given access to in service to the whole, in service to life. And there is work that needs to be done on many, many levels of reality.
Llewellyn, how do you relate to this notion of witnessing the pain and the allowing ourselves to grieve for what we've lost, like Joanna Macy talks about and you talk about, and the aspect of that's cutting through the denial and just as if we can continue as business as usual, versus what to me feels like perhaps a complementary truth, which is the value of us consciously cultivating or consciously placing our attention on that which is emerging and that which is where the creative life force is coming through, as a way of encouraging that aspect of life to emerge more fully. How do you see those two attitudes working together?
Yes, this is important. I really think they are two sides of the same coin. You can't have one without the other. You have to grieve for what is happening to the world, and what Joanna Macy talks about, how that grief can actually open your heart. When Thich Nhat Hanh says you have to hear the sound of the earth crying, and he also talks about the bells of mindfulness, which I think is a wonderful expression. That what is happening in the world are like bells of mindfulness for us to wake up. So then our heart is touched. When you really feel what is happening to the world, it takes you deep within your own heart. And then as a mystic, I am, drawn in prayer, because that is my response to suffering is first of all, what can we do? Yes, but we offer it to God, like we offer our own suffering to God. And, for example, I have a particular practice which I teach my students of putting the earth as a living being into our hearts and offering it to God, that His mercy, that His grace, or the Beloved's mercy, or the Beloved's grace, comes into the world and helps it in its time of need. We know this, how this can happen in our own journey, how we have been in very dark places, places of despair. And at that time, our heart cries out to God that we get the help that we need. And grace comes, and our life often changes. And it's that moment of change, that moment of transition that you're talking about, that is from a culture that is dying to the seeds of what is being born. And then you also work with this regenerative energy that comes from prayer and the actions that come from prayer. And then something that had been dying can come alive in a new way. I personally believe that the future is going to be very, very different to the culture of the past. Given some glimpses in meditation of what it could be like, it's a culture founded upon oneness. It's a culture founded upon an awareness of the sacred that is present in everything. And yes, there are wonderful technologies we will be given, but only if we step aside from the grip of the ego, of the me, into the we, and a we that is not just a human we, but a we that includes all of creation, because that's what we are. We're part of this living, breathing, spiritual being we call the earth. And then we each have our part to play in the world that is being born, in the world that is regenerating itself. And this is what you are talking about in this program. Is like a seed that is thrown out into the collective of humanity for those whose hearts or minds or souls are ready to receive this seed, and then what will grow is part of the whole mystery of life regenerating itself, because I believe that life creation is a living organism. It has its own consciousness, it has its own destiny, and we are part of it. We are part of this living organic whole. This is not the hierarchical framework of the past. This is a much more feminine, integrative approach that requires listening, that requires receptivity. You go inside in prayer. What part can I play? You speak to the earth. You speak to the beings within the earth. You speak to, if you are drawn to, you speak to the angels. How can we work together to help this world to be reborn? Because what we think of as a human crisis at the moment, with all the divisiveness and the rich and the poor and the 99% or the 0.1%, is actually part, as far as I can understand, David, is part of the earth itself being reborn in a new way as a spiritual being, because I believe the earth is a spiritual being, and it's going through its own transformation. And we can participate in that, and we can help it to be reborn. And that is, again, I go back to my sense that anybody who's been given a glimpse of their spiritual nature, and you know how precious that is, that the world is not just about materialism, as somebody once said to me years ago who'd just woken up. She said, I was amazed to discover it wasn't just about getting stuff. And, you know, then how can I play a part in this great awakening of the world? And I think it's a tremendous time of opportunity and of possibilities that the world can change. Yes, many things have to die. We live in a completely unsustainable, humor-driven madness, pathological madness. There's no other way to describe it. And it can't sustain itself. The world can't sustain it. It's destroying the fabric of the earth. It's destroying the soul of humanity. We're here to witness what is sacred, not just to get more stuff. And so, yes, we have grief for what is dying, for the pain that is being inflicted on the earth. And then we also look towards the dawn, look towards the light that is coming. And how can I participate? What part can I play? How can I offer myself in service to life, to God, to oneness? However you call it, it's all the same.
Llewellyn, I'm curious in your sense of the current situation, and you wrote that book, Darkening of the Light, which was a sober tale that you told, and I did find it challenging personally to open to some of the things there, and you tell of the experience you had of around the millennium having this sense of this potential, this new light, this new energy coming into the world. And you wrote so beautifully and hopefully about this possibility. I remember you saying that it had the energy of almost like a newborn, like the archetype of the cosmic child.
Does, yes.
Right, and representing this possibility of oneness and really a new spirit that's available to shape the future. And then, though, you write about how sadly, your experience and your perception on a deep inner plane was that as the years progressed, the forces of darkness were resisting the emergence of this new possibility. And in fact, you know, this sense that the light, the collective light, really was extinguished, and really as if humanity had made their choice to turn away from that possibility and to continue on this path of materialism and greed. And, you know, that's a challenging idea to take in.
I can give you a little example of that before you continue.
Yes.
That, to me,
yes,
highlighted it, which is in the first climate change conference in Rio, there was a talk about sustainability. And the word sustainability there was used to be as sustainability of the whole. When the word sustainability was used, it was how can the world be sustained as a living whole? And then a decade later or more, when we got to Copenhagen, the use of the word sustainability had subtly changed. And now, no longer than talking about the sustainability of the whole, it was how can our civilization be sustained by the world? How can we sustain our energy-intensive civilization? And to me, this is like the heartache or the heartbreak when we turned away from our responsibility for the whole as a collective. And we really said, you know, business as usual. What matters is us. And, you know, that's when, like Joanna Macy talks about, I had to really to face this tremendous grief at our decision to forget why we are here, decision to forget the recognition of the sacred, that we're all in this together, and this focus on sustaining our present civilization, which, if anybody looks with any sense, is unsustainable. It doesn't make sense. It's pathological. And I had to deal with that grief and that pain, and that's, you know, one of the reasons I wrote this book, Darkening of the Light, which of all my books actually sold the least, because it tells a story people don't want to hear, that we've lost something. And it doesn't mean that there can't be a change, David. It doesn't mean that the world can't make a shift. But it won't be quite the same as before. And since writing that book, and I've actually been written, Darkening of the Light was the fact that we have to witness what is happening, that we can't avoid it. We can't hide in our spiritual practice. We can't hide in our nice gated communities. I live in a beautiful little village, and, you know, in California we have a wonderful farmer's market. We have ecological food. We are sustainable. You know, I have solar paneling on the house, but I am still part of a world that is completely unsustainable, that is polluted, that is every time I get in my car, I am part of that. And so I feel we have to witness what is happening. Yes, and that's the reason I wrote this book, Darkening the Light. We have to witness what is happening in the outer world and also what I've been forced to see in the inner world. And then recently, since writing that book, I have sensed, well, what can we do? What part can we play? Is witnessing just enough? And the recent book I've been writing, which is called For the Love of the Real, says we can do more through our spiritual practice. And this to me is very important because, as I say, I've been involved in deep spiritual practice since I was 19. We can connect, for the Sufi, within the heart or other parts within the soul, to something that is true, that is real, that is not polluted, that is not about what we can get, but is about whether you talk about the pure light of the Buddhist, the bodhicitta, or whether you talk about the empty mind of the Zen practitioner or the spirit guide of the shaman. We can find something in us that is not polluted, that is not contaminated, if we really are sincere in our practice. And then my sense is we need to bring that inner light, that love, that connection with what is real. That's why I titled this book For the Love of the Real. We can bring it into our life, into our practice, into our community, into our way of being. And then we make a real contribution to the world that can be born. Because, again, what is most precious within the human being is this light of the soul, is this spark of what is divine, is this remembrance of the sacred. There are 10,000 ways to kneel and kiss the ground, as Rumi says. 10,000 ways to pray, 10,000 ways to be true to our innermost nature. And then that's why I like this Kabbalistic saying I said earlier. First we receive the light. This is what happens in our practice. Whatever practice you do, you go to that light within you. Then we impart the light. Then we bring this light into the world, into our community, into our heart, into our service. Whatever we do, we bring this light through. And then, finally, thus we repair the world. And it's this, more than just witnessing, it's the act, the spiritual act, that this subtle act, this subtle service, this subtle activism that we can do to repair the world, and that spirit is central to it. And that's why I think your work is so important, because this spiritual, subtle work that always belonged to all spiritual cultures before us, before we forgot about the inner worlds, before we laid waste those sacred groves in the inner worlds before, was always part of it. And this is the joy, the passion. We're all in it together, and we work with the inner worlds. We work with the devas, we work with the angels, we work with the entities. You know, they had this wonderful experiment at Findhorn, I'm sure you know about, when they took this destitute piece of ground, and working with the devas, they produced these wonderful vegetables. And that's just a little example of what working with the inner worlds can mean. And there are powerful forces in the inner world. I was taken there in my early 30s. They taught me about the inner worlds, the changes that are happening, how to work together with them. And it's been foundational to my work since then. And then there is a possibility for the future, not this flat earth society that has even permeated so much contemporary spirituality that they don't know about the inner worlds. And spirit is spirit. Matter and spirit have to come together. There has to be this alchemical marriage that the alchemists spoke about centuries ago. And then we can give birth to the world that is waiting. You mentioned it before. I've seen this cosmic child with stars in its eyes, which is the archetype of the New Age. Incredibly beautiful, David. Oh, this is joy. This is a life. And it's, you don't need stuff then. If life is joyful, you do simple things with service. You don't need all this stuff. You don't need all these distractions. You don't need all these video games. You don't need any of it, because there's a simple joy about being alive, about being part of this sacred earth that is so beautiful, but at the moment suffering through our neglect, through our desecration.
It seems that as we're talking, what I'm struck by is that so much of this shift is this very delicate opening of the heart, and it does occur in that subtle way, which seems like why the practice, emphasis on the practice, is so important. Like we're in a culture where we're so accustomed to debating ideas and having that sort of confrontation intellectually, but it feels like this shift is something that happens in a much different way. A shift to the heart and to this sort of innocent opening, and you know, I was very curious about something you wrote in this article on spiritual empowerment, where you're talking about, I think you mentioned there that there are hints in the ancient texts of various mystical traditions about specifically how to engage the light of the individual with the light of the world, how our light, inner light, can affect the light of the world, which is very squarely in this topic of subtle activism. But you also wrote there that many of these possibilities are very new, and that part of our moment is about truly a step into the unknown, which is itself, can itself be a form of spiritual empowerment, where we, if we trust the light to show us, to reveal to us the possibilities, that we'll discover some new practices, new possibilities. And this I find actually personally very exciting and very interesting, that perhaps together, and especially maybe as we tap into our collective spiritual intelligence, that we might co-create new forms of how to bring about healing at the collective level and how to be in service to the whole. So it feels like it could be quite an exciting spiritual adventure, yeah, if you like.
Oh, tremendous. I mean, that's, you know, when you talk about co-creation, that you know, makes me so happy and joyful, because that's how it's supposed to be. There is no deus ex machina. There is no, you know, transcendent God who's going to resolve our problems. That is the idea of a father figure who's going to come down with his hordes of angels. Yes, there are hordes of angels, and there is tremendous power in the inner worlds, but we have to work together with the power in the inner worlds. And, you know, the difference is, I grew up in the 50s and the early 60s, and spirituality wasn't present in the West in the way that it is now. And then all these traditions came, whether the Hindu or Sufi or meditation techniques and Buddhist traditions came to the West, and they brought us practices of meditation, vipassana, or sacred chanting, many, many practices. And that's why I think it's really important that if you're involved in this work, you find a practice that suits you, you find a prayer that suits you, whether it's mindfulness, whether it's silent meditation, whether it's Sufi zikr, or whether it's like the Thomas Keating, who brought back this centering prayer, the prayer of the Desert Fathers. You find a prayer, a practice that grounds you in yourself, that opens you, what I call, to what is real within you, to the deepest recesses within you. And then you learn how to work with it. I give you a simple example of a Sufi practice, which is we work with the heart. And there is this initial work the Sufis call polishing the mirror of the heart, which is a work of purification. On our particular path, a lot of this purification is psychological. You work with the shadow, being aware of the shadow, of the rejected darkness within yourself. And while you're doing this, you're polishing the mirror of the heart, because the heart is a mirror. And then when you go into prayer or meditation, the light gets shined into your heart. And then the heart can use the mirror of the heart, reflect that light in the world. For example, you know, there are places of darkness in the world that need light. The Tibetan Buddhists have a slightly similar practice, but they actually take upon themselves the darkness of the world and transmute it. We reflect light into the world. It's a very esoteric practice. It's not written down hardly. But through in your prayers and your meditation, you take your attention to where light is needed. There is a description of Sufis of a brotherhood of migrants who keep watch on the world and for the world. And this has traditionally been part of our spiritual work. And then you can also use that light to co-create, to bring new new ways of understanding into consciousness. I firmly believe, you know, when I started this work in the year 2000, and oneness was not interdependence, oneness was not part of the collective spiritual consciousness at the time. And yet as a mystic, I was very aware that it is a central understanding that everything is one. It's a primary mystical understanding. And my sense is over the last decade, that spiritual idea has become more and more part of our collective spiritual understanding. It's no longer fringe to talk about oneness, to talk about unity, to talk about interrelationship, interdependence. And again, you know, to go back to the Pope's encyclical, why I find it so moving personally is for the last 15 years, I've been talking about the cry of the earth and the spiritual body of the earth and the fact that the ecological problem is a spiritual problem. And often, David, it's been like a voice in the wilderness. There's not much out there. If you Google spiritual ecology, there's not much out there. And suddenly to hear from this amazing man who has this reach to billions of people, and it, to me it's very moving that, you know, he took his name after St. Francis, who loved all things, everything was his brother and sister, and had this deep love for the earth. And to see that idea that for many years was a fringe idea, suddenly it's in the mainstream. When I read it first, he even quotes a Sufi mystic in it, which is very, very moving for me. I just was just filled with tears, because that is how we bring these ideas from the spiritual world into the collective. And then the next step, David, and this is what is, I think, so important, is how are we going to work with them? And this is why he talks about the cry of the earth and the cry of the poor, and the whole idea of integral ecology that works together with the human suffering and the world suffering and the suffering of the poor and this terrible divisiveness in our culture of rich and poor, which since globalization has been getting worse and worse, and it shouldn't have happened like that. And, you know, then we really are co-creating. How can we create, the world our heart knows is possible? How can we come together? And this is why your program is so important. It can reach out and touch hearts, and then something in the heart responds. And you know, I always say first you pray, and then you act from a place of prayer. The Shakers, American spiritual tradition from the last century, you know, they talk about hands to work and hearts to God. And I like that, because how can you then participate from a place of prayer, from a place of pure intention from the spiritual. And what is interesting, David, and this is something I was taught when I first came to the Sufi path many years ago, that we each have a work to do if we offer ourselves in service. And some people's work is in the inner worlds. Some people's work is in prayer. Some people's work is in praying for the world, praying for others, holding a place of light in the inner world, holding a place of pure intention. And some people's work is in the in-between worlds, in the symbolic worlds. This is where the images are formed that create cultures. Carl Jung talked about the archetypes as being the riverbeds of life and the great decisive factors in life. And many people are drawn to work either through art, through symbols, through dream work, to work in the inner world. And this is very important. And then other people who are maybe more grounded are drawn to work in the outer worlds and bringing communities together that can support a life-sustaining work for the future. And all those different ways of participating, of being of service, of helping the earth, of helping each other. When I say each other, I include the birds that come to my bird feeder in the morning, all of it. How can we all work together? How can we each play our part? And then, as you say, we are co-creators of the world that is waiting to be born, but it needs us to midwife it into existence.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that might be a beautiful place to bring this conversation to a pause. And it has been a very full and rich time with you. Just wondering, is there perhaps any one simple thing that listeners to this call might do to put into action in their practice or their spiritual life some of these things that we've been talking about today?
Yes, David, I feel a very simple thing to include the earth in your spiritual practice. Mm-hmm. The earth is going through a terrible crisis at the moment. We have been treating it and continue to treat it abusively. And it needs to be remembered. It needs to be remembered as a sacred being. And so whether it's in silent meditation, in prayer, however you are drawn into your practice, include the earth in your practice. It's interesting, David, we know how to pray for others. When somebody is sick, when somebody is going through a troubled time, those of us on the spiritual journey often pray for that person, and we know that prayers work. Many, many examples of prayers work. And the earth is also going through a very difficult time. The earth is also suffering. And we need to include the earth in our prayers. So I would just ask all those who are listening that whatever practice you do, it can be walking meditation when you feel the earth is sacred. I go for a walk every morning. I meditate and have a cup of tea, and then I go out for a walk where I live. And I like to feel the sacred nature of the earth, of the trees, of the this morning the fog, and to feel, in a way, an offering of myself, of my own prayer to this world. So I would just say, whatever way you are drawn to practice, whatever way you are drawn to pray, include the earth in your prayers, because it needs us more than we understand.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, Llewellyn, for that closing wisdom and for this whole conversation. And thanks all of you for listening, and a great way to launch our summit with Llewellyn Vaughan Lee. So be sure to join us for our next session with Patricia Albert. But until then, namaste. Have a beautiful day.
Thank you, David.
Thank you for joining us for the Summer of Peace, brought to you by the Shift Network. For more information about joining our global community dedicated to helping people awaken to their divine humanity and take inspired action, visit www.theshiftnetwork.com. To learn more about the Summer of Peace and the World Peace Library, visit www.summerofpeace.com. Thank you for sharing this summit with your friends and family. We appreciate your dedicated support.